Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
I'm excited to talk about limited stage small cell. I think the goal of this is really for us to present some data and discuss it in the context of a case and then have a discussion together about how we're integrating this data. So this is a real patient from my clinic. This was a 78-year-old female who was actually in surveillance for a history of a previously resected stage 1A lung adenocarcinoma 3 years prior. She was in surveillance and on her, at this point now, annual chest CT. She was noted to have a right upper lobe nodule, which was new from a scan done 1 year prior. A short interval follow-up CT scan was recommended by radiology on the chance that maybe this new nodule was inflammatory, but unfortunately that scan showed enlargement of that right upper lobe nodule, as well as a newly enlarged right hilar lymph node. This was a fairly healthy 78-year-old woman. Her past medical history included just hypertension and hyperlipidemia. She had good performance status, and as you can see here in the social history, she had a 50-pack year smoking history and had quit about 15 years prior. So here is her imaging. You can see the right upper lobe nodule on the CT scan, as well as a fairly sizable right hilar lymph node, and both of those had significant FDG uptake. There's a little bit of uptake in a paratracheal lymph node as well. Her PET CT and brain MRI showed no extra thoracic sites of disease. So this patient underwent a bronchoscopy and endobronchial ultrasound by her thoracic surgeon, and the large right perihidal nodal mass, which is contiguous with the right paratracheal lymphadenopathy, was identified, and a corneal biopsy of that right hilar mass was obtained and showed a small cell carcinoma with a high proliferative index and synaptophysin positive by IHC. So this was overall staged as a T1B, N2, M0, stage 3A, or limited stage small cell lung cancer. And she presented to us. She had never met a medical oncologist at the time of her initial resection of the stage 1 lung cancer, so I met her at this time. So how do we think about treating patients with limited stage small cell lung cancer? I will say this is something that we do see in clinic, thankfully not so infrequently. Sometimes these are picked up on screening. Sometimes these are picked up on surveillance. Sometimes they're picked up incidentally between screening scans for patients with a smoking history. I think for patients with limited stage disease, I will say that I think a full staging, so brain MRI, and I can't remember if I mentioned on the prior slide, she did have a brain MRI that did not show any disease. But full staging is incredibly important, of course, including invasive mediastinal staging to really assess nodal status. I think it's an evolving space, but there is discussion of surgical resection and adjuvant chemotherapy in the very early stage disease. I think we're, you know, still trying to understand which patients can really benefit from a surgical approach. Generally, we think about this only for really small tumors, certainly with no nodal disease, but there's no randomized data to guide this approach. And so a lot of times it can be that patients come to us having had surgery, not knowing prior to the surgery that they had small cell cancer. But for most patients where we know they have limited stage small cell, concurrent chemotherapy and radiation has long been our standard of care. And that standard of care, as we often say in small cell, hadn't changed in quite some time. For these patients, the chemotherapy regimen is generally cisplatin etoposide, as in the metastatic setting, given for 4 cycles, with concurrent radiation. Now, the radiation schedule can be 45 gray given twice daily over 3 weeks, or once daily 66 gray given daily over 6 weeks. The field has been somewhat evolving in terms of BID versus daily radiation, and maybe in the discussion we can talk about how that's approached. I would say, based on some of the more recent data, including the CONVERT trial I've shown you here, our radiation oncologists have been favoring BID radiation for those patients who can come for the twice daily treatment. And generally, we try to start radiation with the second cycle. So often what we do for these patients, we'll start the first cycle of chemotherapy, during which they'll receive radiation planning, and then introduce the radiation with the second cycle. And then for frail patients or older patients where concurrent chemotherapy and radiation is not available, sequential chemotherapy followed by radiation is a reasonable alternative. And many of these patients are frail because of either age or comorbidities. So I would say that is also an approach that we take not infrequently. Now, we can certainly talk about PCI, prophylactic cranial irradiation, radiation. The data has also evolved. You know, we used to think of PCI having a survival benefit, and then in some of the kind of updated data, I think that that has been thrown into question, and whether the older studies really had robust brain imaging prior to PCI, or whether some of those patients had undiagnosed brain metastases. But nevertheless, for limited stage small cell, we do still consider and discuss PCI, particularly for patients who have good performance status and are younger, who don't have baseline neurologic conditions. And I think a really important point is that if patients do not have PCI, then close CNS monitoring with serial brain MRIs, which we really do at the time of every restaging scan, I think is really critical to monitor given the high rates of CNS disease with small cell lung cancer. So I mentioned that this has been a standard of care for quite a long time, but thankfully we are now starting to see changes, just like in the metastatic setting. And this year at ASCO, at the plenary session, we saw the presentation of the ADRIATIC study. This is the study design of ADRIATIC, which is a phase 3 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study looking at kind of a similar design to PACIFIC, if you want to think about it, analogous to the non-small cell setting, where patients with limited stage, stage 1 to 3 limited stage small cell lung cancer, with good performance status, received concurrent chemotherapy radiation, must have finished chemo RT and not progressed on those first scans. In the study design, PCI was permitted before randomization, but not required. And then at the time when they were shown to have non-progression after concurrent chemotherapy and radiation, patients were randomized to durvalumab, 1,500 milligrams every 4 weeks, or placebo. There was a third arm of the study with durvalumab and tremelimumab, which has not read out as part of this. So really the data we have now is looking at Durva, and I should add here that this was given for a maximum of 24 months versus placebo. And the primary endpoint here was a co-primary endpoint of overall and progression-free survival. And I think you're all familiar, you've all heard and maybe read the New England Journal publication about this, but this was a strongly positive study. And, you know, the overall survival, which was a dual primary endpoint here, strongly favored the addition of durvalumab after chemotherapy and radiation compared to placebo, with a really striking improvement. So the hazard ratio here was 0.73. Median overall survival in the placebo arm was 33 months. And median overall survival on the durvalumab was 56 months. So more than 20 months, nearly a 2-year improvement in median overall survival, I think quite striking for this patient population, where we know the risk of relapse is really quite high. So, you know, I think this is really a compelling data set, but as always, we have to be careful about toxicities. And I think in general, the take home from this data set was that using durvalumab after chemo RT was something that didn't show unexpected side effects. It's something that we're used to doing again in the non-small cell setting. And we saw, you know, we did see pneumonitis, radiation pneumonitis of similar magnitude in both the placebo and durvalumab arms. We saw immune-related adverse events, including hypothyroidism, but not a significant difference between the two arms. I will say, kind of getting a little bit more granular in terms of pneumonitis here, if we look at pneumonitis or radiation pneumonitis as a group term, which I think is really perhaps the right way to do it, because often in clinical practice, it's hard to distinguish whether something is radiation-related pneumonitis or immunotherapy-related pneumonitis. The rate of any grade pneumonitis using this grouped radiation or any pneumonitis term was 38%. You can see that on the top right there, in 30 with durvalumab or 30% with placebo. Thankfully, the rates of high-grade pneumonitis were quite low, but nevertheless, as in the non-small cell patients, I think we do have to be mindful of these patients, particularly as many of them have underlying emphysema, COPD, and so pneumonitis can be something that can be clinically significant for them. But I think that, you know, this really is a compelling data set. I think many of us have moved after this, given the approval of durvalumab in other settings, to using this for patients who complete chemotherapy and radiation, even after the data was presented at ASCO. But I think there are many questions that we can discuss perhaps together. You know, are the unique safety considerations of immunotherapy in the context of combined modality therapy here? You know, how do we monitor and manage these? Are there additional approaches that we should be thinking about to enhance the further on the efficacy of chemotherapy and radiation? And what impact might these have on future protocols? And again, how do we think about the radiation piece, once daily versus twice daily? How do you decide? Is that something that you discuss together with the radiation oncologist and with the patient? So maybe should we have some discussion and then come back to my patient? Or maybe I can, Maybe I'll just finish up my case and then we can talk. So my patient received concurrent chemotherapy and radiation with BID radiation to 45 gray, which overlapped with cycle 2. Given her age of 78 years, she did not receive PCI. We discussed it, but felt that the risks of PCI were too great in her age. And therefore, she's been having close MRI surveillance, initially with scans every 3 months, and now we're actually a couple of years out, so starting to space those out. She did not receive durvalumab, as this actually happened a couple of years ago, but were I seeing her in clinic now, I would have offered her durvalumab, and she remains in follow-up after completing treatment. So thank you.
Terrific. I guess I'll switch places. Okay. Actually, let's just go back to that discussion slide. Okay. And I think these are some great questions, and maybe we can start with this and encourage any folks from the audience to come up as well. I guess my first question to you, Zosha, would be, are you using this already? You said that if you had a patient now, you would be encouraging that to...
I would be. I have not personally had a patient yet in my practice, but I know my colleagues have. And so we as a group have already started to think about it. I mean, the data, it feels hard to not use it given how strong the data looks.
Yes, I completely agree with that. How about you, Arminia?
Yeah, same for me. You know, in my new institution, I see several small cell lung cancer, and we started using it, you know, not everywhere we could use it immediately because I think it didn't have a J code immediately. So, but now I think it's picking up. I mean, definitely there is a huge improvement, you know, with consolidation durvalumab after chemo radiation.
And they are getting chemo plus, I mean, they are getting radiation and they've had the concurrent chemo radiation and are going to have the durvalumab. So, tell me a little bit, that first question, what are you thinking in the patients that you see? Who might you not consider or have trepidation about recommending the durvalumab?
I think, it's a question that, again, in some ways I think we're a little bit more comfortable doing this now than we would have been, you know, 10 years ago before we did this so much with Pacific. I remember when Pacific, which was the analogous study in non-small cell, came out, we had many discussions about whether this would be safe, whether the rates of pneumonitis would be prohibitive. And in the non-small cell lung cancer experience, my clinical experience has been that the rates of pneumonitis are probably a little bit higher than what we see in the studies. And so it will be interesting to see how that pans out for small cell, but nevertheless, you know, overall safe and reasonable. So I think, you know, it's something we have to be cautious about, but seems to be from the safety data so far that it is acceptable. I think the contraindications here are going to be patients, as with other immunotherapy contexts, who have underlying autoimmune disease and serious ones. You know, I think certainly things like lupus or multiple sclerosis or things where, you know, that there we really worry. Patients with solid organ transplants where we worry about the immunosuppression. As in the non-small cell setting, I imagine it'll be a discussion for someone who has, for example, rheumatoid arthritis or, you know, psoriasis or something where the risk of exacerbating that are not quite as significant. But I do think we have to be careful about patients developing pneumonitis. This is a sick patient population with high rates of underlying lung disease, often associated with a heavy smoking history. So I think we'll have to watch them really closely for any sign of respiratory symptoms or any sort of respiratory deterioration.
Yeah, so other than the autoimmune diseases, you know, and the patients who are really on current treatment for autoimmune diseases, I think, you know, if a patient hasn't developed a pneumonitis during chemoradiation or after chemoradiation, I would offer it definitely. Then, you know, it can happen that you might have to stop, but, you know, as we know, immunotherapy might also work for, a few cycles. It will be as much as we've seen, in the Pacific trial for non-small cell lung cancer. Yeah, I agree with Dr. Pietroska that small cell lung cancer patients are more inclined to develop pneumonitis just because, they're a sicker population with more COPD. I mean, the true small cell lung cancer, you know, is 99% related to smoking. And so we have to monitor them more closely, but you know, we are successful in treating them with chemo radiation, so I don't see any reason to withhold immunotherapy on them.
Now, in that trial, and the forest plot actually showed, and this is similar to the Pacific trial, mm-hmm. that those patients who were randomized within 14 days mm-hmm. did better. And I think the question that has come up in clinic, because the day that you randomize is obviously not the day that you start the patient, but how comfortable or how long would you wait before you would start the durvalumab? And I know that's a tough question, so.
I mean, I reason like, you know, for non-small cell lung cancer. So basically patients, I usually look at a CT chest just to make sure that there is no significant progression. I mean, it's difficult to evaluate response so quickly. So unless there is a significant progression, you know, let's say a new mass or a new met, then I proceed with immunotherapy.
Yeah, I think we're ending up doing our scans earlier than we mm-hmm. used to do. So, okay, let's move to PCI because you brought that up. And I know that that's a really, that's an area that's, it's still a little gray. We used to, refer patients for PCI in limited stage. And I feel like a lot of them got that. And now our RADONCs are really not as excited. Do you want to comment on that, Zosia? I know that there are trials out there too.
Yeah, I would say, I guess, you know, one thing to say is the longer I've been in practice, I have a few patients who for various reasons have had PCI, whether for limited stage small cell or, you know, a long-term responder, even with metastatic disease, many, many years out, who've had pretty, you know, significant side effects from PCI. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good reminder that PCI is not an easy treatment for patients to receive. And so I think it can't be undertaken lightly. And I think the data, you know, that we used to rely on was somewhat flawed in terms of the benefit of PCI and, you know, whether we were truly, it was truly prophylactic or treating kind of undiagnosed brain metastases. So with all those caveats, the conversation that I've had with our radiation oncologist has been, yes, it's something to discuss, but really in select patients, you know, in young patients who are otherwise well. I think as patients get older, you know, once the 70s, certainly any later than that, I think the enthusiasm from a radiation oncology perspective, but also from my perspective, falls off. And I think patients have to be counseled that, you know, that the data is still out there. I believe there's an ongoing trial mm-hmm. of PCI versus close observation.
Yeah, I'll talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be really important. You know, that's, I believe, you know, for patients with metastatic disease, but I think it's really important to do those studies because in the era where a survival benefit was shown, patients were not having serial brain MRIs. And if you do that, then, you know, perhaps you can spare them from some of those toxicities. So I think our enthusiasm at our institution has really fallen. We do still do it occasionally, but it has fallen over the years.
Right. Another consideration is that the current trial is actually the MAVERICK trial, and it's considering the hippocampal sparing radiation therapy that could be a little bit better in the safety profile, you know, in memory loss rate than the prior approach. So, and also, we have to consider that the MRIs now are more precise. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the old trials did not really use a strategy of so much close monitoring. So I think, you know, these two trials that are ongoing will prove, you know, if really there is an advantage in survival doing PCI.
Oh, there's a, thank you. Please, thank you for, I think that's Dr. Vogel, is it?
So you remember the Greek guy? He said, first of all, do no harm. And I think whole brain radiation for someone whose brain works does a lot of harm, and it really isn't clear that it does a lot of good. So if you think the patient is never going to show up again, maybe you might consider it. But if you can remember to show up and he'll listen to you, I would do serial MRIs and not radiate a functional brain. The worst thing that can happen is if the patient is cured, you've radiated his brain, and he can't remember where he parked his car, he can't remember where he put his keys, or worse, he's nonverbal. And these things happen. I've seen it. It breaks your heart. You finally cured a small cell, and he can't function. Oh.
Yeah, that's why it's so important to look at these new trials. They're ongoing. I completely agree with you.
Until the trials show a benefit that's really substantial, 1% won't do it. Because you're radiating 99% to help the one. It's got to be a substantial benefit. Mm-hmm. I largely wouldn't do it.
And I think people, these patients sometimes have CNS disease that recurs, and then you're limited in terms of what you can give because they've already received radiation sometimes. One more question before we move on. Zosia, you know, there was a trial that also reported out relatively recently, the NRG-LU-005, with a concurrent atezo followed by atezo consolidation, and that was negative. Whereas this one showed that overall survival benefit from 55 months to 23 months. So what's going on there?
I think it's a really interesting question. And again, I mean, I think, you know, we think of small cell as a different disease than non-small cell, but I think we can also draw some parallels. So, you know, this is all somewhat analogous to what we're seeing in non-small cell and in stage three unresectable non-small cell, where clearly the Pacific study was strongly positive and, you know, changed our standard of care now many years ago. But the Pacific 2 study that looked at the addition of concurrent immunotherapy to chemo-RT followed by immunotherapy was negative. And similarly, you know, here again, we're seeing that for whatever reason, adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy and radiation doesn't add benefit and doesn't improve outcomes. And I don't think we fully understand why that might be. I would say, you know, I'm sure some of it has to do with safety and toxicity, but some of it seems to be perhaps more complicated than that. But I was surprised by those results, just as I was by Pacific 2. I don't know that I have a good explanation or a good, you know, understanding of why it was, but
I think we need more correlative studies and more program. But, you know, one idea could be that you need the full chemoradiation to elicit the immunotherapy response. Yeah. Because, you know, what we're seeing is very consistent in non-small cell lung cancer and small cell. And also, you know, there are other, for example, head and neck, that the concurrent didn't work. And it was a huge flop, actually. You know, and over, you know, in the head and neck is also different because you radiate lymph nodes in the neck. So it's a different story. But here, I think it's pretty clear. You know, you need to do the radiation first, full dose, to elicit an immune response.
Well, and maybe that's a segue into your next topic, which is extensive stage. My question first to you would be, this is showing almost a two-year benefit in overall survival. We know IO alone in the metastatic setting is showing a benefit, but of about 3 months. So what's the difference there? Why so many years? Is it just that those patients are already going to do better, or what do you think?
Well, you know, in the metastatic, first of all, is there also a question probably of tumor burden? You know, like these patients are metastatic, so you know, once it gets to extensive stage, you know, you might think that it might defeat, actually there is more immunosuppression, and you're not able to rescue these patients. But you know, of course, these are all questions that are very good to ask. So basically, the idea is that we should really promote the screening to try to find these tumors earlier, because we can cure them. The problem is that small cell is a really bad situation, because you can actually miss from 1 year to the other, you can miss the small cell, and you can basically have an extensive stage situation. So I think for small cell, you know, I wonder if for heavy smokers, we have to change the guidelines for screening.
And Dr. Vogel.
So these studies that look at concurrent versus sequential, they are different patient populations. The sequential population is gated at people who've survived and look good after the chemo radiation. So maybe it's just that the IO is bad for those patients. And so if you include them, you lose the obvious benefit for the whole population. And that's why the survival curves look so good. They look much better than the Teresi survival curve from BID radiation, about 10 or 15% better at 5 years. Because, hey, these are all people who survived and didn't progress.
And that's a great point. I mean, that is the
Adriatic. So it's a different population. And it may just be a population effect, that those people who are going to do badly do even worse if you give them immunotherapy in the first month or so of treatment.
I mean, you're right in thinking that the patient selection plays a huge role, because, you know, you think about who are the patients who are found to have an earlier stage small cell are probably the asymptomatic ones, right? To do it for just an incidental finding or for screening. And that's why they're going to do better anyway, right? So that's very interesting.
There's every reason to think that there's a difference, real difference, in the limited and the extensive patients. That there's something about the cancer that makes it not go to the liver quickly.
I think that's a great point, and I think that there are there's interest in looking, for example, at limited and extensive and the subtypes, and do they represent molecularly different diseases, or is it just, you know, or for exactly?
I don't think there's any reason to think screening for small cell will actually do good. From the studies of screening were all designed not to find small cells, because they figured they're all going to die anyway.
Yeah, I think that the data so far has not actually shown a real increase in the detection of small cell with the screening studies.
So but, I suspect yeah. that the bulk of because the extensive patients are extensive right after the cancer gets its last hit. The last thing it needs to be a small cell. And some of them will be a small cell and metastasize, have a big primary, even bigger nodes, and not have metastasized, obviously. And a fraction of those can be cured with largely local therapy.
I will start with the clinical case. So this is a 57-year-old woman, heavy current smoker, 50 and higher, actually, back here. She presented to the emergency room with the right neck pain and right neck mass and shortness of breath. Physical exam showed a large right neck mass, face and neck swelling, and CT chest, abdomen, pelvis showed a large 7.1 centimeter right upper lobe perihilar mass, inseparable from adjacent pathologic mediastinal and right hilar lymph nodes, including a 5.5 centimeter anterior mediastinal mass and a necrotic 3.2 centimeter pathologic subcarinal lymph node with associated mass effect upon the SVC, which is markedly narrowed. And then she had two liver lesions. The largest was 1.8 centimeter that was biopsied and showed small cell lung cancer. Brain MRI was negative. So these are the CT imaging showing this very large right upper lobe mass and lymph node involvement, including superior vena cava syndrome. So, So what treatment do you advise in this situation? So this is the first line extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So platinum etoposide plus atezolizumab or plus durvalumab, platinum etoposide, clinical trial, all of the above. But I'm not gonna do the, let's see what would you do, but. Okay, so, you know, all of them actually are good answers, so we're not gonna say who is the winner. So for the first line trial, there were two trials that led to the approval of what is currently first line treatment. So IMpower 133, there was the addition of atezolizumab to platinum etoposide, and Caspian, which was the addition of durvalumab plus etoposide in carboplatin. They both had very similar, actually, a control arm of chemotherapy, which was 10.3 months, and the IO plus chemotherapy was 12.3 for the IMpower 133, and the median survival was 12.9 for the Caspian. So if we put them side to side, they are very similar. As I said, 1 year survival rate was 51.7% for IMpower 133 and 54% for Caspian. So, basically, you know, we could have treated that patient with, so I'll tell you what happened later, but, you know, very often these patients are very symptomatic, especially with superior vena cava syndrome, and so they end up in the hospital, admitted to the hospital. It's very difficult, actually, to get approval for immunotherapy in addition to chemotherapy. So some of these patients are treated with the first cycle just with chemotherapy alone. For the other question. So if you can go a little bit backward. So what would you add actually to prevent the cytopenias for caused by chemotherapy. Would you add trilaciclib? Would you add pegylated G-CSF, or you would not add anything? Okay, and basically you said trilaciclib or G-CSF, and some of them, none of them. So there was a pooled analysis of three trials that was done by Dr. Ferrarotto that showed that trilaciclib, which is actually a CDK4/6 inhibitor that preserves the immune cell function and also at the same time blocks in G1 state the hematopoietic stem cell progenitor, so causing actually less neutropenia, in general cytopenia, so thrombocytopenia and anemia. So when this pooled analysis was done, it showed a significant improvement in the reduction for transfusions and also for prevention of neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. So, of course, you know, there is a problem that in the cost benefit, so that unfortunately we have to face this reality. So trilaciclib versus pegylated G-CSF. Of course, with trilaciclib, you're not going to protect for neutropenias, but you're going to protect also for anemia and thrombocytopenia. So the patient was started inpatient with carboplatin and etoposide with improvement of symptoms. She was seen outpatient before the second cycle, and actually she was proposed a participation into a clinical trial that allowed one cycle only of chemotherapy before enrollment, and she accepted. So after four cycles of platinum etoposide and checkpoint inhibitor, the patient achieves a response or stable disease. What do you advise? Continue atezolizumab or durvalumab until progression of disease? Intensify treatment or observe off treatment until progression of disease, or offer PCI? Okay, so the majority chose to continue the IO alone. And this is true. This is the current standard of care. What I want to mention is that there is a clinical trial, it's called the IMforte trial, that randomized patients who achieve response or stable disease after four cycles of chemotherapy with platinum etoposide and atezolizumab to continue atezolizumab alone versus to add to atezolizumab lurbinectedine. And actually, we had a press release on October 15, 2024 from the Jazz Pharmaceutical that say that the combination of these two drugs in maintenance actually demonstrated statistically significant improvement in the primary endpoint of overall survival and progression-free survival, and then also that it was safe. Of course, we're awaiting the full presentation and the manuscript for this trial. So at the moment, it's not approved. So the correct answer would be to continue IO. We discussed the PCI before, and I will show you a few more slides about the PCI. So it is an evolving role in extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So there are two trials that were published, and I have to thank Dr. Simon Ling for this slide and the following slide. So one is the RTC study that actually was published in 2007, and it showed a survival benefit. And the other one is the Japanese study that was published in 2017. So these two trials that did not show a survival benefit. So these two trials, probably they are different in the, in as I said, in the MRI potency, I think, because, you know, of course, 20 years ago, it was different than today in discovering the brain metastasis. And also in the radiation therapy techniques. So there are two current trials. One is the MAVERICK trial that I mentioned, is a SWOG trial, and the other one is the PRIMA LUNG. So they randomized patients to a hippocampal sparing radiation therapy versus surveillance. And they're very well defined in the frequency of the MRIs, usually every 3 months. So we'll have to see what these trials will show. So now the patient progresses after 5 months. I noticed that Dr. Chang actually put the pre and post evaluation 2 months. So it's a little bit different from last cycle of platinum etoposide and has still a performance status acceptable PS1. So what do you do? Restart carboplatin and etoposide and continue the checkpoint inhibitor, start lurbinectedin, start topotecan, or refer or start tarlatamab. Okay, interesting. So it would be between lurbinectedin and tarlatamab. Okay, so these are the second line options that we have as of today. So the topotecan was actually approved in 1998, and it's about 3 months median progression-free survival, lurbinectedin 3.5 months progression-free survival, and tarlatamab most recently 4.9 months, and has been approved this year. So what is the tarlatamab? It's a bispecific antibody T-cell engager. It targets two different antigen. One is anti-CD3 and the other one is DDL3. So what happens is that it promotes, engages the endogenous T-cell and small cell lung cancer cells, promoting T-cell activation and proliferation. And also on the cancer cell side, promotes serial lysis of the cells and tumor cell apoptosis. Delphi 301 was the trial, the phase 2 trial that showed an improvement actually in progression-free survival in patients who were pre-treated for small cell lung cancer. Tarlatamab was given at 10 milligram or 100 milligram IV every 2 weeks. The primary endpoint was a response rate. The response rate was 40% in the 10 milligram group. Median progression-free survival was 4.9 months, and the median duration of response was 9.7 months. So the extended follow-up curves were actually presented very recently at World Lung. And it showed that 12 months progression-free survival 24%, which is, I think it's remarkable. Median progression-free survival was 4.3 months. When we look at the median overall survival was 15.2 months, and 12 months overall survival 57%, 18 months of 46%. So this is a promising drug. 26 patients had sustained disease control for at least 52 weeks or longer. There were 3 complete responses, 20 partial responses, and 3 stable diseases. However, you know, the safety profile needs a particular mention because this is a bispecific T-cell engager. So it can cause cytokine release syndrome and another syndrome, which is called ICANS, immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome. For the cytokine release syndrome, it usually happens in the first 2 doses. It was 51% for the 10 milligram dose and 61% for 100 milligram dose. And that's why the 10 milligram was actually chosen because it had the less incidence of cytokine release syndrome. As I say, the most are actually happening in the first 2 doses. So therefore, you can actually refer patients if there are standalone practices without capability to monitor this patient and admit them for the first 2 cycles, you can actually send them, refer them for the first cycles, and then treat them back once they are safe to continue in an outpatient setting. So there was grade 1 cytokine release syndrome in 1% for the 10 milligram dose and 6% in the 100 milligram dose. So usually the common symptoms of cytokine release syndrome are fever, hypoxia, and hypotension. So this patient might actually need to be moved to ICU if the symptoms actually, if the hypotension especially is not responsive to steroids. Then for the ICANS, it was 8% in the 10 milligram dose and 28% in 100 milligram dose, and most during cycle 1 with a median time to onset of 5 days. The common symptoms were confusion, impaired attention, tremor, and motor findings and weakness. The treatment discontinuation rate due to the adverse events were 3%. So I think we have another question. Yeah, so the patient decides to proceed with tarlatamab. After 12 hours from the first infusion, she develops myalgia, fever, tachycardia, and hypotension without hypoxia. Upon further evaluation, she was diagnosed with a grade 2 CRS. And so which of the following treatment would be appropriate for this patient? Monitor the patient carefully, but no other intervention needed. Monitor carefully as outpatient for 8 hours, initiate IV fluid and acetaminophen, admit to the hospital and provide IV fluids, acetaminophen, and corticosteroids, admit to the hospital, provide corticosteroids and tocilizumab. Okay, so this is a CRS2. So the majority of people here chose actually admit to the hospital, but then now we need to clarify if to use just corticosteroids versus corticosteroids and tocilizumab. So I want to, I'm sorry that this is very small, but this is actually the algorithm that I advise everyone to look at. It is included in the prescribing insert package for tarlatamab. And it shows the advised treatment for each grade of the CRS. So in this particular case, the patient was diagnosed with grade 2. So definitely we would have to admit the patient, provide IV fluids, and then steroids. So the tocilizumab is actually, you know, to be considered. So you can also avoid to use tocilizumab and then monitor the patient and see how she responds to the treatment. Now, a grade 3 CRS, that's when, you know, we will have to admit, move the patient to the ICU because there is an hypotension, for example, that is refractory to corticosteroids. So it's very important that if a patient has a reaction at one point, then for the subsequent doses, you have to make sure to admit the patient and monitor, or at least monitor for 24 hours, the patient. I also added the ICANS algorithm, which is based on the ICE scoring, which includes basically orientation, so evaluation of orientation, of naming, following commands, writing, and attention. So there is a score, and according to the score, you know, there is the diagnosis of the grading of the ICANS. And of course, it will require, for example, a grade 2, it will require neurological consultation, then steroids, and then admission of the patient. So the patient also asks about molecular tests. What do you advise? It is not indicated in small cell lung cancer. It is indicated only as part of the clinical trial. I would request only if patient is a never smoker.
Single baby. Sophisticated mama. Come on, you disco lady.
Okay, so I have to tell you that this is a controversial, so there is no indication really at the moment in a standard of care to do molecular testing. However, if a patient is a non-smoker and has small cell lung cancer, I would recommend to see if this is an evolution from an EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. But if we go into some data, you know, the only thing that we really find is the PARP inhibitors in small cell lung cancer. So small cell lung cancer is sensitive to PARP inhibitor, even if they are BRCA negative and HRD negative. So this is different than other tumor types. Small cell lung cancer show different, significantly elevated PARP1 mRNA expression and are sensitive to PARP inhibitors. So there is a molecular findings, is SLAFEN-11, which is actually, you know, evaluated by immunohistochemistry, is expressed in 50% of small cell lung cancer, and is the dominant mechanism of response for the PARP inhibition in small cell lung cancer. So there were different trials, meaning second line. There were three trials that showed that SLAFFN11 immunohistochemistry predicts for improved survival. However, there was a trial in maintenance after first line where patients were randomized to receive the PARP inhibitor versus atezolizumab alone. So PARP inhibitor plus atezolizumab in this case was talazoparib. And actually did not show any improvement in the overall survival. So it's still an open question, and that would be interesting to understand from the other panel member if they're using actually PARP inhibitor in small cell lung cancer. Another drug that we haven't talked about so far is lurbinectedin, which is a selective inhibitor of oncogenic transcription. In phase two basket trial, the response rate was 35% with the disease control rate of 68%, and it was approved as second line and above. In the Atlantis trial, did not meet the primary endpoint of overall survival. Currently, in the Lagoon trial, is under evaluation for lurbinectedin plus or minus irinotecan versus investigator choice. So let's go to what is actually what are the novel drugs. There are several drugs that are currently under development, mainly the ADCs. So I will talk about the B7H3 ADCs. There are three drugs actually in trials. The first two are more like far advanced. One is ifinatamab and the other one is HS-293. So ifinatamab has a topo one payload and is shown in 18 patients with small cell lung cancer to have 59% response rate with a median duration of response of 5.5 months. The HS-293 is also another B7H3 targeted antibody drug conjugate that has an exatecan derivative and also showed a response rate around 58%, however, a small number of patients. This is control rate of about 80%. So there is another drug that was recently presented at the ESMO 2024. It's called the YL201. This drug is very interesting, has a drug antibody ratio of 8. So it actually showed to be more powerful than the other ADCs. So there was a dose escalation. It was done in different tumor types. And then there is the dose expansion. When you look at the dose escalation, all the data that were presented for extensive stage small cell lung cancer, all these patients were heavily pretreated and almost all of them received an immune checkpoint inhibitors and they progressed on carboplatin, on platinum etoposide. And they had actually 33% of patients also had brain metastasis. So when you look at the response rate, was 68% for the all extensive stage small cell lung cancer. The median progression-free survival was 6.2 months. And then when you look at the brain metastasis patient, also the response rate was still 52% with a median progression-free survival of 5.3 months. So in conclusion, I wanted to ask some questions. So one is actually the design of small cell lung cancer trials, because we should definitely allow patients who are pretreated at least with one cycle of chemotherapy to go on the first line trials, because usually this patient present with heavy symptom burden, they are admitted inpatient, and it's very difficult to get them ongoing for clinical trials. So to avoid, to miss actually the real world patient, we should make sure that our designs for clinical trial take into consideration this finding. The other is role of intensification of treatment after achieving response in stable disease. So this is an ongoing question, because I think, you know, small cell lung cancer patients, we have noticed that really the IO maintenance doesn't really work that much. So patients who actually have these beautiful responses after chemotherapy, like 4 or 6 cycles, then unfortunately end up having relapses early on. And then tarlatamab, of course, is the new drug, and it's, you know, it's a wonderful, it's been a wonderful year for small cell lung cancer with the approval of the Adriatic regimen and tarlatamab. However, for the majority of community-based practices, it's very difficult to refer patients for tarlatamab, because, you know, like academic centers or hospital-based practices are a little bit overwhelmed, I think. And so what happens is that patients are referred, but then, you know, it takes like 2-4 weeks to see them, and then the patient progresses very quickly, and unfortunately we can rescue them. And then I think the biomarker evaluation for small cell lung cancer is still like very controversial. We don't have good biomarkers to test.
I see, Dr. Vogel, you have the floor for one question.
So,
thank you.
Sorry. We should mention that there's a randomized study from France looking at retreatment versus topotecan in patients with small cell that relapse 3 months or more after their chemotherapy is stopped. And retreatment with a platinum and a topoisomerase beat topotecan. Topotecan barks. It's a dog. We should never give it.
I think we know it as topotecan at this stage, yes. But thank you, yes.
The other thing is the early use of topotecan, the people who do a lot of bispecific antibodies and CAR T cells keep giving it earlier and earlier and earlier for cytokine release syndrome. There's a study from Amsterdam in myeloma where a bispecific antibody, they routinely give the tocilizumab before the patient has cytokine release syndrome, and they can keep the patient from getting sick and having to go to the hospital, and they're starting to give it as an outpatient. So while maybe it's not indicated now by these charts that were written by the drug company that just wanted to get their drug to market, I suspect we'll be giving a lot of it quite early in the future so that we can give the drug more often and keep the patient from being incarcerated in a place where he'll get the wrong medicine.
I fully agree with you there. I think we have a lot to learn bispecific-wise in terms of managing CRS, and we can learn a lot from our heme colleagues. And I do think that prophylactic TOCI is something that we should consider in the future, although we're not quite there yet.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.